Good morning. It is Sunday, October 28th, 2012. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Callum.
And I'm Christina Thomas. AETN, Fayetteville Public Library, and KUAF invite the public to a free screening of Solar Mamas. It's part of community cinema. It will take place this afternoon at 2 at the Fayetteville Public Library. In this film, a mother of four joins other poor women from Guatemala, Kenya, Burkina Faso, and Colombia to learn concrete skills to change their communities. AETN.com/community cinema for more information.
And Katie Hendrickson, Ozarks at Large and KUAF's own Katie Hendrickson, will moderate the discussion following that.
Right, right. And then tonight, she has Sunday Symphonies from Sunday Symphony.
Right.
With multiple symphonies. Though,
right.
From 7 to 9.
And this is what Katie calls a day off, by the way.
Right,
she's,
right.
She's not working the fundraiser. She's just moderating and doing a program. Speaking of the fundraiser.
Right.
This is the on-air fundraiser for KUAF. And I'm imagining that you listen to KUAF and public radio on Sunday because you like to stay informed. We have Weekend Edition, which we just heard. Later, there will be On the Media, one of the most important public radio shows I think exists. And TED Radio Hour, just and All Things Considered later this afternoon.
Right.
All those programs are also unique to the radio spectrum. Public radio takes the time to provide an in-depth look at issues to tell a story. No one's better at telling a story than the folks at Ira Glass and This American Life.
Yeah, I was going to say This American Life.
Putting a human face on the stories and using sound in very compelling ways. We're not driven by ratings. That's because we're supported by listeners. Listeners like you. It is only with your support that we're able to provide a unique Sunday listening experience on your radio that you've been relying on, perhaps for years or decades. You can help support us at 575-5823 or 800-522-5823. You can also pledge online at supportkuaf.com.
Right. Ozarks at Large has been in, we just went daily 2 years ago.
Right.
But it has been in this time slot for how many years?
Oh, it's probably been on Sunday mornings now for maybe 20 years.
Yeah.
19 or 20 that it started out on Saturday, then we expanded it to Sunday, right around a couple of decades.
It's a long time. I wonder how many of our listeners have tuned in on Sunday morning just for Ozarks at Large.
You know, I don't know.
Right.
I wonder how many of our listeners, we've probably got a few listeners who are listening on Sunday morning who weren't born when I started this when I was on Sunday.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe it's a chance.
Yes.
And if you have been listening for 20 years, or if you haven't, it's time to call and support.
Right. If you appreciate not just Ozarks at Large, but all the programs that are on Sunday, including Prairie Home Companion and Living on Earth. Remember, all these programs are made possible directly through your financial support. 800-522-5823 or very easily and securely online at supportkuaf.com.
All right. And thank you.
Okay, now we find her grave. I have to go down that stump. Okay, we need to take a right here. Walk right up here to where it says Humphreys.
Yes, we are in a cemetery. Though it's almost Halloween, we aren't here for a ghost tour. Well, not really. My guide is Libby Wheeler, historian and member of the 20th Century Book Club. The club marked its 100th anniversary last month, and to celebrate, club members placed flowers on the graves of four founding members, all of whom happened to be buried in Evergreen Cemetery in Fayetteville.
Okay, and I believe she is going to be right here. Mary J. Bocock Willis. She died in 1937. She was the really initiator of the book club, and she was married to a Presbyterian minister. And they were in Searcy.
She founded the Searcy Institute for Young Women. When she moved to Fayetteville with her husband, she was astounded that there wasn't a book club, a women's study group, because there were in other places, even in Arkansas.
And I think the reason was because the university was here and it had a library and there were other intellectual outlets for women maybe that weren't available in other towns. She, along with three other women, founded the book club. Now she was president from 1912 to 1916, and then she and her husband went to North Carolina.
She rejoined in 1936 for 1 year before she died. The purpose of the group is book study with some altruistic work. More on that in a bit. The 20th Century Club held its first meeting in September of 1912, meeting twice a month in people's homes. The first three books they researched were Tennyson's Idylls of the King, Thomas More's Utopia, and Henry VIII by Shakespeare.
And that took all year to do, though, meeting twice a month, because they had study questions and people were assigned research projects to do relating to the period of that Thomas More lived in, and little sketches of Wolsey and other figures of the period. And it was very serious.
So serious, in fact, that there was a very strict roll call. Barbara Taylor, another member of today's book club, tells more.
People would often respond with a relevant quotation or a fact that related to the reading that was done. And this was beyond their assignments, which were more in-depth research on topics related to the book.
So, like, they would say Libby Wheeler, and then
you would respond. I would give an example for the Tennyson book chivalrous experiences of that period or something.
We walk to the northwest corner of Evergreen Cemetery. The other three founders are conveniently buried near one another.
Okay, on the left over here, we are looking for Lessie Stringfellow Reed. And Lessie was a columnist and, was she the editor, Barbara?
Yes.
She was the editor and columnist of Roundabout Town for the Democrat, which was the predecessor to the Northwest Arkansas Times.
Lessie came to hold national office in the National Federation for Women's Clubs, working as their editor. The Women's Club movement at the time was a tremendously powerful force, socially and politically. Lessie Stringfellow Reed was a very unique person. In addition to being a newspaper woman, she was also a spiritualist. Adopted, Lessie was named after a brother, Leslie, who died as a young adolescent.
And they had seances at their house every night. They used Ouija boards. They did, you know, a number of things that to us seem quite outré. But at the time, perhaps not so much so. For example, one of the people that they became acquainted with and formed a friendship with was Robert Louis Stevenson, who was himself into spiritualism and the occult, if you will. But in the case of the Stringfellows, it was very much an effort to recapture their lost son and to stay in touch with him.
A bit of an eccentric, Lessie was strong-minded and smart. Plus, she had quite the book collection. The next 20th Century Book Club founder we visit is Lila Davis Pearson.
Mrs. Pearson.
Mrs. Pearson. She grew up in Sulphur Springs in Benton County, and again, loved books. She was a Sunday school teacher at the First Christian Church in Fayetteville. It was the First Baptist Church in Fayetteville for 50 years, and organized the Evergreen Cemetery Association. Her husband was a practicing attorney.
Interesting fact, the Pearsons adopted a young boy from the orphan train when it came through Fayetteville. There are still Pearsons practicing law in Fayetteville today. In fact, it was Mrs. Pearson's daughter who found the club's old yearbooks, which list the books and members for each year. We make our way to the fourth and final founder's grave.
Okay. Laurie Hughey was a speech teacher in Ohio, a young woman, very attractive. Her parents moved to Fayetteville, and she came to visit them, and she met Mr. Charles Appleby, who was a pioneer in the canning industry in this town.
The Applebys actually bought and restored the old Tibbetts house, the headquarters house. The club held many meetings there, even planting a tree in the yard. When the club was formed back in 1912, dues were $1, augmented by fines for tardiness, for not appearing at all, and there were big fines if you did not fulfill your duties. Fines have long since gone by the wayside, but there are still dues. The dues help the club perform their altruistic work. In addition to the four founders, there were 8 charter members, one of which was the first librarian at Fayetteville Public Library, a benefactor of the club's charitable endeavors.
In the minutes of 1919, the club had a $25 annual pledge to the library, and that continues today. It's a little more than $25, nice, but not a whole lot.
And we started folding KUAF into our lists of organizations and that we would support.
And the Ozark Society, because we had members Lois M. Hoff and Maxine Clark, who were very interested in saving the Buffalo River, and the International Exchange for Students that we've contributed to.
And Headquarters House was again one of the...
And I think we contributed $25 to the fence to put around Evergreen Cemetery to protect our heritage.
Because this is not a real fence.
Though they maintain the charitable heritage, the 20th Century Club is run just a bit differently. Life is much more hectic than it was 100 years ago. The club meets just once a month now, and only in the months September through May.
We don't study as much as we used to. In fact, there's been a real evolution in the way the club works, and it's been an evolution in the direction of informality. It used to be that books were assigned to members, and a little bit later, members were allowed to choose the books they reviewed, but they had to be approved
by a committee.
Yes, approved by a committee. And in alternate years, we either act as hostess, that is, the club meeting is at our home and we prepare tea and coffee and dessert for the group, or we review a book, and the book that we choose is pretty much up to us.
But to mark the club's 100th year, the books to be read this year were chosen a bit differently.
This year we are, because it's our centennial year, choosing a book from each decade of our history. Well, almost a decade. We don't have quite enough months to do it in. And our first review this year was All Quiet on the Western Front, a book from World War I, which was a wonderful review.
And through history.
And the first... fiction book that we, well, that was reviewed in the club was, I think, in 1919, The House of Mirth.
Did you notice that Libby and Barbara both are saying review? See, unlike most book clubs, only one person is required to read the book. Then they report on that book to the group. Unusual, but that doesn't mean that there isn't discussion or opinions. This year, Barbara will be performing the April review, reading Reinventing Womanhood by Carolyn Halbrin. It's from the 1970s and 80s. Libby won't be reviewing this year, though she did research and produce the club's history, which was an important job. It's the first few pages of the club's centennial member book. Each of the 24 members, see, they have a limit to membership. New members must be voted in. Each of the 24 is highlighted in this special yearbook, given the opportunity to tell about themselves and why they joined and loved the 20th Century Book Club. Here's Barbara.
I think that we wanted to join partly because of the members, because they're so interesting, the women who are members. And they really are in many, many ways. And it's a very congenial group. I think we like each other. We like getting together. We enjoy our monthly meetings and look forward to them. So.
Both Barbara and Libby, like most of the women of the club, are very involved in the community. As we are in the 21st century, no longer the 20th, there was some discussion about changing the club's name. But they decided they were very happy celebrating their roots. Obviously, they're interested in history. So the name remains. The club also maintains its original motto.
Esse cum videri, esse quam videri, which means to be... but not to seem to be.
And in other words, to be genuine, to be real, not to pretend to be something other than what you are. So they were very down-to-earth women in many ways, too.
To be intellectual if you want to be, or to be have good women friends, but not to flaunt it and still be the mother and wife that was expected at that time.
The 20th Century Book Club celebrates its 100th anniversary this year. I spoke with members Libby Wheeler and Barbara Taylor at Evergreen Cemetery earlier this month.
This is Ozarks at Large. It is the on-air portion of our fall fundraiser, 800-522-5823, or you can pledge online. Maybe I hope you're having a very slow, sort of sleepy Sunday morning. You can pledge online at supportkuaf.com.
Voices, the voices of people. Words, words that might not otherwise be spoken. Stories, stories that might only be told because of public radio. Voices, words, stories. All of these are what you hear each day on public radio and on Ozarks at Large. We give you the opportunity to experience the stories of extraordinary and regular people alike. Now is your opportunity to support public radio with a financial gift. Please donate right now by calling 575-5823 or 1-800-522-5823. I really think that we at Ozarks at Large bring stories of Northwest Arkansas and the Ozarks and River Valley that you don't find a lot of places.
I think you're right. I mean, the story we just heard that you did with the women from the 20th Century Literature Club,
right. History,
stories, you're not going to – we have the time. We have the luxury to do that. Other mediums might not have that luxury. That would not be a great story on television if you only had 45 seconds or a minute to tell it.
Right.
It wouldn't be as good as what I think we just heard. That's not to knock television. Television can do other things that we can't. But what we have here is the luxury of an hour at a time to tell you three or four or five stories per day. And if needed, sometimes, like when Ify Agnihotri was still here and did a series on poverty, spent a couple of days with a woman who was trying, who's a member of what would be tagged the working poor, and found out what her life was like. Ify spent a long time. And we spent 20 minutes on the air with, I think, a very interesting,
it was a great
story,
right. But yeah, there isn't another medium that you could...
No, and we try to match that, I think, on Ozarks at Large and the medium, and a nice marriage of the two.
Mm-hmm.
The conversation that's coming up that I had with Richard White, the historian, again, that's not something that would work for commercial radio because you have commercials and you interrupt. I don't think it's fair to have someone like Richard White in the studio and then use 3 minutes.
Right.
I mean, I could have... There was much more that we could have...
Right. It could have taken up the whole hour.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Right. He's that interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so I think that's the value in having an Ozarks at Large available to a listening audience. I don't mean that to sound egotistical or you know.
Right.
But I think no matter who is producing it, and there are other places where you can hear that. Colorado Matters is produced in Denver. It's a weekend show, and I heard that the last time I was there. Very good show that took time to explore the people and places of Colorado.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's just like, you know, This American Life that follows.
Yes,
absolutely. It's on at 10. What other... I mean,
no.
They spend time on, you know, one topic and really explore the people and... Yeah.
And I think, and the reason commercial stations don't do that is because it's not commercially viable.
Right. It costs money.
Right. And there aren't advertisers who say, oh, you're going to do 48 minutes and then I get my ad in. That wouldn't be smart for them either. The reason we don't have to worry about that is because so much of our support comes from listeners. And I think that works to our benefit. We know it works to our benefit. And I think it works to your benefit, too, when you're listening to This American Life or on the media, knowing that you'll be able to hear these stories given the amount of depth that they require.
Right. Well, if you value the depth and all the energy and what goes into producing Ozarks at Large and This American Life, then pick up the phone and call us this morning. We have volunteers in the conference room waiting, and the phone numbers are 575-5823 or 1-800-522-5823 or supportkuaf.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. History and the present can have parallels. This is quite apparent in the book Railroaded, The Transcontinentals and the Making of Modern America by Richard White. He is the Margaret Byrne Professor of History at Stanford University and the author of 8 books, including The Middle Ground, Indians, Empires, and Republics in the Great Lakes Region, a book that was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Last week, he was on the University of Arkansas campus to discuss the men and processes that made the railroads possible. And as part of the Hartman Hotz lecture series at the University of Arkansas, he delivered a lecture titled, What is the Purpose of the American Economy? A History Lesson. He came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio last week. He says, while many in the 21st century would say the purpose of the American economy is to buy things and keep people employed, that wasn't the prevailing thought more than 150 years ago.
That's the sort of common sense answer, but that's not necessarily the answer anybody would have given you in the 19th century. In the 19th century, the purpose of the American economy was to produce democratic citizens. A democracy to survive had to have citizens who were independent, who were secure, and who in fact had what they called the time a competency. And an economy that didn't provide those things was not a successful economy.
In what ways could you make a successful economy then?
The way you make a successful economy was you had to make sure that everybody had the opportunity to earn enough money to support their family and put something aside for bad times in the future, because I presume there would be bad times, that everyone had to have an even chance, that the worst thing that could be in an economy is when they thought some people had special privileges, and that the result of this economy they thought would be a society which they thought they'd had at about the time of the Civil War of not very many very rich people and not very many very poor people. As a matter of fact, what they thought is that any economy that produced very rich people was also going to produce very poor people, and it was a sign of problems with the Republic.
Are you talking about the 19th century or the 21st century?
I'm talking about the 19th century sometimes sounds like the 21st century, and that's why very often deep down in these political campaigns you hear echoes of the 19th century, is that it's not that their programs are going to do anything about it, but if you listen to both the Obama campaign and you listen to the Romney campaign, they keep trying to make the other side enemies of security, enemies of opportunity, and advocates of special privilege. And in that, they're really hitting at very old and deep American values, which go back well over 100 years.
You mentioned that this was the thought before the Civil War. The Civil War takes its toll on the economy.
It's about the time of the Civil War. Remember, what the Civil War was supposed to do was it was eliminating slavery. It was going to, in fact, eliminate the great anomaly in the American system. It was going to eliminate what they saw, Northerners saw, as a privileged class of slave owners. And it was going to eliminate those who, in fact, could not benefit from their own labor, which is slaves. So they thought at the time that what the Civil War had accomplished is finally brought about what they saw as this sort of golden ideal of American democracy. And the great symbol of this, of course, is Lincoln and Lincoln's Springfield. This was a time where there were very few rich people in American society, and now they thought with the elimination of slavery, there would be no poverty that could be blamed on anybody but the person who was laboring themselves. So that Lincoln gives these speeches where he'll say, in this free labor economy, you will be rewarded for your efforts, and that nobody, except unless they have incredibly bad luck or are naturally dependent, is going to end up poor. They really thought they'd achieve that level. They, of course, are tremendously wrong. The rest of the 19th century will prove them wrong, and this politics comes out of trying to understand what went wrong, what's going wrong now that we thought we'd achieve success.
You, in fact, have some people build up the largest amounts of personal wealth in the history of this country.
Yeah, and those are the people who become – I mean, it's odd now that those people are admired and seen as entrepreneurs. They were hated at the time. I mean, you go back through the political cartoons at the time, and they are seen as creatures of special privilege. They're seen as people who are being rewarded by legislatures, by being granted charters, corporations, which give them the ability to do things ordinary people can't do. And worse than that, they cut the opportunities of ordinary people. So that over and over and over again, the problem with the rich is not just that they're rich, but by giving them the special privileges, it allows them to limit the opportunities for other people. And what you have in the late 19th century is incredible turmoil, because what they're arguing about is not whether the United States should be capitalist, but what capitalism means in the late 19th century. There's relatively few socialists in late 19th century America, but there are bitter arguments over what a democratic capitalism should be.
These arguments played out in newsprint?
They play out in newsprint. I mean, all you have to do is go through 19th century journals from, you know, Punch, Wasp on the West Coast, and you'll find some of the classic American political cartoons. And they're symbols we still use now. The large, top-hatted, fat, cigar-smoking tycoon is a creature of the late 19th century. And the octopus is a symbol of monopoly, which is not just one railroad. It's used over and over again. These kinds of things become these classic political representations. And what they're all connected with is this idea that it's special privilege that is creating these things and that it hurts everybody and it has to be eliminated.
You mentioned that you had a certain naivete before you started researching this. I imagine researching, investigating history is a great way to get rid of naivete.
It is, but it takes time. I mean, right. Railroaded took me about 12 years. And essentially what I do, and what many historians do, is I read dead people's mail. And what I tend to do is just start at the beginning of a long set of correspondence and read it through. I was tremendously lucky with the people I was writing about because they were smart, they were funny, they were utterly cynical, and they were inventing things as they went along. So they have to explain it to each other. And it turned out that Leland Stanford, who was not the sharpest tool in the shed, had to have an awful lot explained to him. So my great advantage was I could sit in for Leland Stanford. It all had to be explained to me. So Collis P. Huntington, Mark Hopkins, all of these others will spend their time explaining to Stanford what he's done wrong and what they're trying to do, what the problem is, which means as a historian, they're also explaining to me.
You say he's not the sharpest tool. That's a charitable thing compared to some of the other accounts you give. It's at this point that I want to point out that you are on the faculty of
Stanford University. Yes, yes, which doesn't bother Stanford a great deal at all. First of all, any member of the faculty of Stanford University realizes they don't matter that much to the university to begin with. And the second thing is that the university has all Stanford's money. There's nobody left to offend here.
You made the analogy earlier about railroads then to the tech world we live in now. In the opening pages of Railroaded, let's see if I can find it here. You write, this was train travel before the Civil War, at once technologically impressive and nearly incoherent. It was exhausting, aggravating, uncomfortable, yet withal far better than any existing alternative Americans were prepared to love trains, hate trains, and be unable to live without them. That sounds like the internet to a T.
It sounds like the internet. It also sounds like I flew in here on an airplane. It sounds like the airline industry. And it's true. These are things which, when they work, allow you to do things which you couldn't even conceived of 10 years ago. You get so used to having them there. When they don't work, it's incredibly frustrating because the other thing they do is they also gradually eliminate all the other alternatives to them. And it's the complaints about Google, for example, right now, is that Google, you know, in my opinion, worked a lot better 3 or 4 years ago. But once Google really begins to dominate a market, now you go through a lot of stuff before you ever get what used to come up right away. So one of the things, this is why the word monopoly occurs over and over again in the 19th century. They begin to realize this dependence, and what they mean by monopoly is the internet's a good example. They don't mean something that controls all of a market. They mean an industry that once it's in place, you cannot live without. And that's what we have. That's what the railroads were. That's what the internet is. So the internet is a very, very good example of that.
Does it make you as a historian bristle a little bit, though, when I make this sort of casual comparison? I mean, and we do this all the time. Like, this is just like that.
Yeah. It does, but I'm, you know, I'm hard to offend. And the other thing is I'm always glad to complicate virtually anything you want to complicate. I think what we always have to do with the initial easy comparison is to step back and see the ways that they're different. And there are real differences between the internet and railroads. You know, Richard John, who's a wonderful historian, people started describing the telegraph as the 19th century internet, and it drove him crazy. He was right. It's nothing at all like the internet. But I think the kind of analogy you gave, which is a broad analogy of simply people's dependence on a new technology and how they use it, that's perfectly fine. If you begin to say the internet works exactly like a railroad, well, I'd say yes and no, because one of the ways that they are like a railroad, and I'll make this as simple as I can. In the internet, as you all know, when you send something over the internet, it breaks it up into little pieces and it goes in all kinds of directions and comes back together in the end. Well, that's exactly the way they used to send cargo over a railroad. Hmm. It's not this sort of straight shot through in a single line. So actually, in the very technique of the internet, it does mirror 19th century railroads, which allows us in computer programs to sometimes mimic how traffic moves on a railroad.
Is it true that workers' comp eventually comes from the railroad work?
It does. It comes in the early 20th century after the time I'm talking about. And it first starts out with precisely for railroad workers, because what we forget about is how dangerous this work was. I mean, even conservative senators, Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts gives a speech where he points out and then writes an article pointing out that as many people as were killed and wounded in the Battle of Shiloh, the Civil War battle, are killed and wounded on the railroads every single year. And that's not counting passengers. That's railroad workers. When I read through this stuff, it's this small-scale carnage. I mean, it's not big accidents, but every day, people losing arms, people losing legs, people being killed. And this mounts up over these railroads, because these are the biggest employers in America, over the course of the year. So it becomes a national scandal, how dangerous it is to actually run a train.
This is what we call a softball question, but here it comes. There obviously is a huge value in a country that knows and continues to know its history. When you think of OSHA might be able to go back to the Triangle Factory fire, or workers' comp coming out of this dangerous work. But we often – this gets – it doesn't take long for something to get shoved into the dustbins of history.
No, it doesn't. I mean, that's why it's always useful to be doing history during a political campaign, when you realize nobody even remembers what somebody said 2 months ago. How are they going to remember 2 years ago, 20 years ago, 200 years ago? But, you know, the fact is all of those events, as distant as they seem, shaped and constructed the world that we live in today. And the other thing it does is that we often see our own issues as unique when there's nothing unique about them. Then, in fact, we have faced situations like this before, and we might be able to learn something about how we reacted at the time. But the United States loves to celebrate the past, but it very rarely interrogates the past. But, you know, I'm a historian, and I live in a family where I'm the only historian, and people use the past in a lot of different ways. And one of the things I've realized is historians do incredibly cruel work. What we do is we take a series of things people assume about the past, people assume about themselves, and we destabilize them. We tear them apart. We shred them. And there's a good reason that people dislike historians. We are very uncomfortable people to have around.
I like that. When you're working for years on a project like railroaded, how do you keep from getting lost?
Well, in some ways, I want to get lost. I can't really begin to get a sense of what was going on in the past until the past begins to confuse me, until I begin to realize I'm in a world where I don't know exactly what's happening, then I'm going to have to figure it out. I mean, as the great cliche goes, the past really is a foreign country. I don't know the customs, and in many ways, I don't know the language. And for me, in a historical project, the best moment comes when I begin to, in fact, get it. I begin to realize, and this scares my wife, but she's been through it before, is the dead people who I'm living amongst are more alive to me than most of the people I see every single day. I know them. I know how they talk. I know how they think. And there's a moment, especially when I have a long run of correspondence, I can see a problem emerging, and I begin to see, I think I know what he's going to do or what she's going to do. And when they actually do it, at that moment, it's sort of nirvana. You realize, okay, I'm now totally among them. I've begun to understand in that world, and I can begin to put it together. And, you know, for an academic, all this sounds pretty mystical, but I think for most historians who spent a long time in the archives, there is this sense that you're piecing together a credible world that you can really defend. And to do that, I first have to get lost.
If people hearing this conversation say, you know what, I do want to know more about history, but sometimes you can walk into a bookstore, be it a physical one or a virtual one like Amazon.com, and you're just inundated. What's the best way to get to find out reliable, well-researched history?
Well, I think, you know, one of the ways to do it is there's a variety of ways. And one of them is to go through people that you already know who, in fact, you think you know history. I mean, you have a great advantage here in this area is that there's a great historian teaching at the University of Arkansas, Elliot West. So one of the first things I would do is I would start reading Elliot West. I would also then start reading the kinds of things that he talks about. Another way is to look at a certain kind of set of prizes, ones that particularly if you're just getting into it reward not only good history writing but good history, but good history writing. You know, in some ways, the Pulitzer Prize does it. In some ways, it doesn't. In other ways, the Parkman Prize does it. There's a variety of prizes which go to trying to look at books that go to being both good history and good writing. I would take a look at those too. The other thing you can do is once you begin to find a set of writers you trust, see who those writers like and begin to read around that. Not all history writing is good. Not all historians agree with each other, but that's precisely the point, is that history is, in the end, an argument, just like politics is an argument, just like everything in our lives is an argument. And in this, I agree very much with the 19th century. The duty of a citizen is to be able to decide who is right, who is wrong, or more right and more wrong, and to evaluate an argument. And one thing you have to do with that is remember what happened before. And that's the critical thing.
Richard White, thank you so much for your time.
Sure, my pleasure.
Richard White is the Margaret Byrne Professor of History at Stanford University and the author of 8 books, including The Middle Ground, Indians, Empires, and Republics in the Great Lakes Region, a book that was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. His most recent book is titled Railroaded, The Transcontinentals and the Making of Modern America. He delivered a talk last week on the University of Arkansas campus as part of the Hartman Hotz Lecture Series, which is sponsored by the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences and the School of Law.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
This morning, we are right in the middle of our fall fundraiser. The numbers to call are 575-5823, 1-800-522-5823, or go online, supportkuaf.com.
Thanks for spending part of your Sunday with us. And if this is a regular habit for you, thank you very much. Here's something I'm going to guess if this is a regular habit for you, KUAF on Sunday. You're a lifelong learner. I bet you use the internet to look up information about your hobbies, your interests. You keep up with what's going on in science. Maybe there's a newspaper spread out in your living room or your kitchen right now, the Democrat Gazette or the New York Times, magazines that keep you updated on how to keep fit, what's happening in the financial markets. You're interested in new technology or you're thinking about what the future holds for healthcare. KUAF and Public Radio and NPR work to educate and inform you. We make sure you stay in touch with what's going on in the arts, in medicine, in education, in your hometown. Plus, you learn about worldwide political events as they unroll. KUAF can do these things for you because of your financial support. Think about how much you value the service. Check your budget, then make a contribution. The number to call, 575-5823, or 800-522-5823. You can also pledge online at any time, including right now, at supportkuaf.com.
We have a story coming up about the arts in Eureka Springs.
Yes.
A musical sculpture garden is being installed on a public pocket park along North Main Street in Eureka Springs, the only one like it in the United States. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich takes us there.
This is what North Main Street Park sounds like. But by next May, residents and visitors will hear these sounds. Renaga Farbiage walks along a stone pathway with one of his musically tuned wind chimes. It's a prototype of a much larger chime installation he will install here, which will play a certain iconic melody.
This is John Lennon's All We Are Saying Is Give Peace a Chance. So the sculpture will be ringing out a message of peace constantly. Part of the interpretation will explain that if you strike the notes in a particular pattern, you will play Give Peace a Chance. But whether you know that or not, it'll still be sounding a call for peace.
Wind chime artist Renaga Farbiage builds musically tuned wind chimes for a living. He markets them at Renaissance festivals and arts and crafts fairs across the country. Born in Germany in 1948 to Ignaz and Helen Farbiage, two Polish Holocaust survivors, Renaga learned fabrication from his father, an inventor and expert in electrical engineering. Renaga's Celestial Winds Harmonic Bazaar, his retail store and workshop, located on Highway 23 south of Eureka Springs, has become a popular tourist attraction because suspended from a large oak tree out front hangs the world's largest musically tuned wind chime. That's according to the Guinness Book of World Records. But Renaga's most noted sound installation to date was staged at the prestigious Walker Arts Center in Minneapolis several years ago. It's a fabrication commissioned for French artist Pierre Huyghe for the exhibition The Quick and the Dead in the center's sculpture garden.
In 2009, I was commissioned to do a sound piece for the Walker Art Institute in Minneapolis by a French artist. It was a deconstruction of a John Cage score called Dream. We took the score for Dream, which was originally commissioned by the Martha Graham Dance Company, and deconstructed the piece into 49 individual wind chimes that were tuned to every single note that John Cage wrote. These are hanging in a grove of trees next to the Spoonbridge and Cherry at the Walker Arts Center in the Sculpture Garden.
Spoonbridge and Cherry, an immense outdoor sculpture created by American artist Klaus Oldenburg. And for Eureka's North Main Street Park, Renaga's designing three individual sound sculptures.
One will be a large marimba-like structure. One will be a chime tree-like. A serpentine chime tree piece that'll actually play a section of recognizable music will be 20 feet long, and it'll be serpentine that you'll be able to tap the pieces individually to get the musical sounds, or you'll be able to, I can see children, you know, just running under this thing, kind of joyfully dancing under the pieces and playing it that way.
And the serpentine chime tree will be made up of 10 groups of chimes, each tube a quarter of an inch in width and 8 to 18 inches in length, depending upon the tone.
The Ozarkophone will be wooden slats tuned in a pentatonic scale, and they'll have a sound similar to this.
The third will be made of huge metal tubes partially buried in the earth.
The Stonehenge-like metallophone and the wooden Ozarkophone, I call it, which will be made out of cedar planking, cedar and walnut planking, will both be tuned in a pentatonic scale, which is similar to the black keys on a piano. For anyone who's ever sat down at a piano and just pounded on the black keys, you can't hit a bad note. So if you want to impress your friends, if you just play the black keys on a piano, if you have any kind of rhythm or timing, you'll be able to play a tune. I also recently learned that most gospel tunes are written in pentatonic scales. So the metallophone will have a sound similar to this.
Patrons understand and play the musical sculpture interpretation will be installed as well. Other artists will also be pitching into this project.
I've been chosen as the project designer and chief sound designer for the Eureka Springs Sound Park, but we'll be collaborating with other Eureka Springs artists in the creation of the sculptural elements to make it a true collaborative project.
The planned sculpture garden is located in one of the most neglected sections of Eureka, dotted with abandoned limestone facades and a few rundown homes. But things are slowly improving. This wooded parcel of land, originally gifted to the city by William and Carolyn Bomberger in 1991, has served as a free parking area for residents who work downtown and as a trolley stop for visitors. In recent years, the city transformed two-thirds of the lot, creating gardens and building walkways, picnic tables, and benches. A public restroom is planned, along with a visitor's kiosk. A new sidewalk connects the park to the shopping district several blocks south. Leatherwood Creek flows to the north just across the street, and Old Depot Spring is located nearby. Members of the Eureka Springs Downtown Network are now responsible for the gardens, but Sandy Martin, chair of the Eureka Springs Arts Council, is responsible for coming up with the idea of transforming this site into a musical sound sculpture park.
We wanted to, at the Eureka Springs Arts Council, we wanted to beautify different locations throughout the city, particularly the points of entry in the city. And North Main was one that was just begging for something. This park was here. It's a beautiful park. It has free parking. It's a nice gateway and a nice showcase going in and out of the city. So we thought this would be a terrific area to do it. Plus, we want to revitalize all of the North Main area. We're getting so jam-packed downtown and so many activities at Basin Park that this also provides another venue for activities, events, concerts, and the musical sculpture park just fit in beautifully.
This summer, the local arts council learned it would receive a substantial grant to start up the project.
We were able to get a grant with the great help of Glenna Booth at the city. We collaborated with the city and the community development project of Western Carroll County. And we applied for a grant through the Arkansas Arts Council and received $6,400 to get us started on this grant. And they loved the idea. We took some sketches that Renaga had done. They said it was unique and fresh, and were real interested in following the project.
Because this district is zoned both commercial and residential, a community meeting was held to inform neighbors about the endeavor, who have all signed on. Outdoor sculpture parks are commonplace across Europe, and we have around 30 of them in North America. Musical sculpture parks, however, are rare. The city of Montreal in Quebec recently constructed Harmony Park. It features tuned drums, marimba, and chimes, all fixed and bolted into aggregate concrete walkways. It's a little sterile looking. Eureka's musical sculpture park, however, will be much more organic, blending in with the forested mountain setting. Renaga Farbiage will spend the winter building the three musical sculptures in anticipation of a spring unveiling. Eureka Springs Arts Council Chair Sandy Martin.
Renaga will start working, has started working on the instruments already, and we're going to unveil it during the 2013 May Festival of the Arts. So it'll probably be right around the beginning of the festival for the kickoff of it, and we're planning some events. We want a lot of kids down here to participate in sound and music and outdoor venue as well. So that's when we're going to kick it off.
And hopefully by next spring, the little unnamed park, blooming with jonquils, forsythia, and sound, will also be christened and named. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us on the phone, avoiding the hubbub here at the studio during the fundraiser, is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Oh, that makes it sound like I don't love you.
No. I didn't mean that. I just mean, you know, there's a
I'm
lot
just
of
being
activity.
Lazy.
Okay.
Well,
I don't blame
fair.
You.
Every once in a while, and it's cold.
Yes, it is.
But I want to talk about something hot that's coming to Fayetteville.
Okay.
Shrek.
The musical.
I love Shrek.
He's pretty cute.
My daughter thinks Shrek looks like her dad.
Oh.
That is not a statement of opinion about her dad.
Right.
But people in Fayetteville are excited for a completely different reason. There's a guy named Jason Moore who grew up here.
A Fayetteville native.
And he, among other things, is the director of Shrek.
Yes, directed it on Broadway. He was also nominated for a Tony for directing Avenue Q on Broadway.
And if you missed Avenue Q, who knew?
Right.
He moved to Los Angeles after college and did all the things struggling actors do and some things they usually don't, like teaching safe sex programs at a high school. And finally got of break as assistant director of the musical Ragtime.
Right.
Which was mounting in Los Angeles and then going to New York. By the time he reached New York, the producer had been arrested for securities fraud and he didn't have a job anymore. So he was in New York on a couch, decided that the fates had delivered him there, so he was going to try it. Pretty soon he was associate director of Les Mis.
Which was a huge hit, of course.
And was directing episodic television like Dawson's Creek. Mm-hmm. And then got this musical about puppets that do things that Muppets would never think of doing.
That being Avenue Q, yes.
And it was supposed to be a TV show.
Really?
Yeah, it was supposed to be a half-hour TV show, and like the producers of Rent asked him if he could turn it into a full-length stage piece.
Hmm.
And he said the most interesting thing, he said, Avenue Q turned out to be about a community of people who come together to overcome adversity and find their place in the world. Just like Rent, and just like Shrek.
Yes.
So how fun. He just directed his first movie, Pitch Perfect, which has done really well in theaters.
Sorry,
I have
Anna,
yet to see it.
Anna Kendrick, yes.
And he will not be in town for Shrek, but we can all bow toward the West Coast where he's just bought a home and say hi and thank him for The Big Green Guy.
And that opens Tuesday night at Walton Arts Center.
Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock on Friday, 2 and 8 on Saturday, and 2 and 7:30 on Sunday, and tickets start at $39.
All right.
If you're looking for something for this afternoon, have I got a choice for you?
Okay.
It's The Living Forest at Hobbs State Park from 1 to 4, Mother Nature and her forest friends in costume. Sort of Halloween-y, but not scary.
Right.
The Legacy of Floyd Kramer at 2 o'clock at the Arend Arts Center in Bentonville.
Who's that?
Who's Floyd Kramer? Mm-hmm. Floyd Kramer was a fantastic pianist. He had the big hit with, now I'm blanking on it, Last Date.
Okay.
And this show actually features his grandson.
Right.
Playing piano. Tickets for that are $30 for adults.
Yeah.
Beauty and the Beast wraps up this afternoon at 2 o'clock at the Benton County School of the Arts High School in Rogers.
Mm-hmm.
Later Life is on stage at 3 o'clock in the brand new, spiffy, shiny Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale.
Right.
Tickets are $10 to $20. And Clayton Conversations at 2 o'clock this afternoon at the Clayton House Museum in Fort Smith is about the history of hardwood.
Right. Some of the people behind the developing Museum of the Hardwood Tree.
Should be really interesting. And Frankenstein, of course, wraps up at 2 o'clock at the Lyric Theater in Harrison.
Except there will be a production of Frankenstein Halloween night at the Lyric.
Oh, that's right. Yes. I forgot. You're right. Yes. He's okay. The smart one.
When it comes to Frankenstein, I keep my tabs on that.
All right. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Elm Springs.
Elm Springs. I know where that is.
Yes. And this is our fall fundraiser.
It is.
On-air fundraiser, when we remind you that the reason we can bring you this great lineup of Sunday programs, it's next, it's Our Glass in This American Life, then it's On the Media, then it's the TED Radio Hour, then Garrison Keillor and Prairie Home Companion. The reason we can bring you those programs, the largest, by far, percentage of our operating budget comes from you and listeners just like you who become contributors to KUAF.
Right. Most broadcast media takes less than a minute to tell the story. We have kind of a common theme this morning that we've been talking about how Ozarks at Large allows you, the listener, to get a more in-depth look at what's going on in the Ozarks.
And more nuanced as
well. Right. That kind of insightful broadcasting takes time, quality journalists, and lots of resources. Listeners like you help pay for the insightful news that you hear each morning and every day, whether it's NPR News or on KUAF's own Ozarks at Large. So please, if you value the what you hear every day, please call 1-800-522-5823 or 575-KUAF or
online at supportkuaf.com. You determine the amount and you determine the method. I'm going to try to have a relaxing Sunday now. I don't have to be back on the air until tomorrow at noon with Daily Ozarks at Large with Antoinette. You?
Relaxing as well. Yoga and family dinner.
Well, that sounds like a great Sunday. Thank you for spending part of your Sunday with us as well, and as you have done perhaps for many, many Sundays. We do appreciate it. Ira Glass and This American Life next. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Thanks so much for listening.
Happy Sunday.